want a revolution. Well, you know.
Good day, friends. Hello, you found it. Welcome to the Rational Revolution. I am your host, Mark Becker. Yes, you heard that right. I am your host, Mark Becker. We'll get into that at the end of the show. And the reason is we have such a powerhouse guest. I want to get to it right away. He's been very gracious with his time today on pretty short notice. If you listen to the show, you're a pretty well-informed person. If you're a pretty well-informed person, you know who this guy is. He needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. This gentleman is a pillar in Wisconsin political commentary. He had a little radio host down in Milwaukee for 23 years from 1992 to 2016. Left his radio show in 2016 to found the media company The Bulwark. And he's a frequent contributor to MSNBC, commentator extraordinaire. Charlie Sykes is my guest here. How are you doing, Charlie?
It is good to be with you, Mark.
Thank you very much. You're the first guest. You're patient zero, I suppose. as we're on the fourth anniversary of COVID. But I want to know. I first off, before we get into things, I saw a little over a month ago you stepped down from The Bulwark. So are you dipping your toes into retirement?
Well, I've been dipping my toes into retirement for several years with very, very limited success. So I really needed to get off the daily hamster wheel of crazy to step back. I mean, there's so much going on this year. I was doing a daily newsletter, a daily podcast, and I just thought, you know, I think I need to have a little bit more perspective. I've been doing this for a long time, so I'm fully engaged. I'm still writing every day. But it's not quite at the same pace.
Yeah, I think it was the Journal Sentinel article about you, but I didn't realize that. I mean, I knew you wrote the newsletter and I read it, but 2,000 words, that's a college paper that you were doing every single day, you know?
It was strapped to the mast. And at a certain point, look, nobody can have a hot take every single day, let's be honest about it. And I think that particularly in this particular news environment, where there's this fire hose of information, misinformation, invective and outrage, you know, maybe the best place to understand what's happening to us is not being right there at the nozzle every single day.
Yeah. Where do you think that is, though? You know, where do people get the best information possible? I mean, The Bulwark is fantastic.
Well, look, there are a lot of outlets out there, and I think this is one of the real challenges, because there's no shortage of information. There's no shortage of source material out there. The question is, how do you sift and winnow what is the most valuable, the most accurate, and what you need without losing your mind? And that last part is important, because it can be too much. So I think that people need to ration their intake of social media, but also find a few sources that they think that they can trust and that are going to give them a sober and reasonable analysis, because there's a lot of people that I disagree with. I mean, sorry, a lot of people I agree with and like very much, who have spent the last 8 years with their hair on fire the entire time. Yeah. And I just don't know how sustainable that is.
Yeah. It's interesting of how, you know, I watched an interview that you did on Frontline, and you talked about how, you know, you're on your show, you were able to kind of start the discussion with the idea of, we all know this to be true, but towards the end of that, it was no longer possible, you know, because of the advent, you know, the invent of fake news and alternative facts and all of that. So I think, you know, one of the purposes of what we're doing here is giving a place for people to have those conversations, much like what you did at The Bulwark. And so that's fantastic. And I'm really glad to hear that you will still be involved, because, you know, as I was driving in today to the studio, and I was thinking about, you know, what it would be like here in Wisconsin and in, you know, common sense, moderate politics without your voice. And so I'm really glad to hear that you're not completely going away. So that, yeah, we do need you, Charlie.
Well, thank you.
So I want to start with this. Last week, President Biden had his State of the Union address. You know, it was a speech that showed his vigor, What did you think of it? I mean, what were your thoughts on the delivery, on the content, all of that?
Okay, well, I ought to stipulate, first of all, that I am I'm deeply cynical about State of the Union addresses. I think that they're they're kind of a cross between a carnival and hour long infomercial.
Yes.
So I generally am not a fan. I've also been very, very, very skeptical about whether they move the needle. I mean, there's a lazy punditry that said all eyes will be on the State of the Union. No, they're not. Most Americans are not going to be watching this.
Right.
And historically, they don't change much now. So just that as background, I was surprised by how effective that speech was for, I think, what you were hinting at. Because Republicans have spent months very, very effectively raising questions about whether or not Joe Biden was up for it, whether he was too old, whether he was too senile, whether he would drool all over the podium. And I think that Democrats were really at the very edge of, if not over the edge, of panicking about this. In fact, you look at the news cycle for the previous 3 days, and it was all about Democratic pearl clutching. You know, should we replace Joe Biden? Should we find somebody else? You know, should he step aside? And then he steps out, and he gives a very, very vigorous speech. Now, there was a little bit of shouting going on there, but on two major things that were accomplished. I mean, he really knocked the legs out from under one of the key anti-Biden talking points, which was that he was too frail, too infirm, and not there. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republicans had given him a gift by setting the bar so low. But he also did something for the mood of Democrats. And again, I'm stressing this because I don't know how this shows up in the polls necessarily, whether it's going to move the needle, to use that cliche. But there's no question about it that that Democrats needed a morale boost, and they got it from that speech.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, he accomplished his most important job, leaving aside the content, which was, of course, as usual with the State of the Union, a little bit uneven. But I found it very powerful that he began by talking about Ukraine and began by drawing a contrast between himself and his predecessor about standing up to Vladimir Putin. I thought that was rather rousing, or certainly rousing for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's interesting, too, as we talk with Charlie Sykes here on the Rational Revolution, that I watched pregame on CNN and MSNBC kind of to see how the stage was being set. And you're exactly right. They talked about, you know, this is the most important speech that he will give in his political career, talking about how, you know, we're setting the stage to with the ageism and all that kind of stuff. And then I watched postgame on Fox News. And you're exactly right. How you played it out, it was Sean Hannity, and you know darn well that he would have jumped over the, you know, he's drooling all over himself. He's lost it. He's got dementia, all these types of things. And he didn't talk about it. And the only thing he could talk about was the fact that Joe Biden looked like an angry old man yelling at people to get off his lawn, you know? And it completely took away that argument of, well, he can't do it.
Right. So they had to pivot to angry old man. The more entertaining pivot, of course, was he had to be on drugs. They must have hopped him up or something.
Yes.
Because that can't be. And this is kind of their go-to. I was telling somebody the other day, I remember after the 2020, I think it was the Democratic National Convention, where Biden had delivered his acceptance speech. It was so effective that there were people like Rush Limbaugh, who were suggesting, well, that couldn't have been live. That couldn't have been real. They must have edited that and videotaped it, because he had to come up with some explanation for why everything he'd been saying about Biden had been essentially refuted in that speech. So to that extent, it was a success. Now, you know, does it change the dynamics of this race? Does it mean that he's no longer the underdog in this race? Not necessarily, but never discount something that changes the narrative and the vibe the way this speech did.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, you know, content aside, the idea that he could get through it with with clarity and with eloquence and And a little bit of feistiness too, which I love. I mean, that was really interesting. And then the moment where he was talking about the border deal, and the camera moved over to Senator Langford, and he mouthed, "That's true."
Yeah,
that was a big deal. I wonder, you know, I wonder what the fallback is going to be for him on that. I hope it's not much, but
it'll be grim. No, it will be grim. As you know, having spent the last 7 or 8 years watching one Republican independent after another be exiled, excommunicated, and you know, shunted off to the wilderness, you can kind of guess what's going to happen with him. But you're right, Biden was feisty, and he was also prepared to be interactive, going back and forth with, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and he showed a little bit of humor, which I think is really important. And a couple of other things happened also. You know, the next day, it was always the follow-up as well, because these speeches don't stand alone. You know, often there's a lag time that there will be the speech, and then there is, you know, the post-game analysis, and then, you know, what is the conventional wisdom and the buzz? And a couple of things happened. Number one, he came out with a surprisingly effective ad where he's talking into the camera and owns his age. I thought it was not terrible.
Yes.
And of course, Republicans served up this incredible gift of having Senator Katie Britt do the response, which became the must-see SNL cold open. Oh, I mean, that's how bad it was.
Yes. Well, and I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was our friend Tim Miller or Bill Kristol. I don't know who, but the best thing that I saw was someone described it as dinner theater. And like, what a perfect, you know, way to say that. It's like, oh my gosh, just seeing the over dramatized, you know. Oh, it was, I wanted to get to that, so I'm glad you said that.
Very unfair to dinner theater, most of which was much, much better and of higher quality than what we saw there.
Right. So we got 30 seconds here. So the idea of, on a scale of Paul Ryan to Bobby Jindal, where was that Republican response?
Oh, I think it's one of the worst ever, because it's going to be one of the most memorable ever.
I agree with that. We're here on the Rational Revolution talking to Charlie Sykes. We're going to come right back here, and we'll continue the conversation. Thanks for being here. Welcome back, friends. You found the Rational Revolution. Mark Becker is your host. We've been talking to Wisconsin legend Charlie Sykes. Last segment, we talked about the State of the Union, thoughts on how that went. You know, Joe Biden kind of ticked off the main box that he needed to show that he could do this. And we briefly touched on the worst Republican response in history. I want to get to a really important topic, and a mutual friend of ours, Charlie, Congressman Reed Ribble. We talked to him a couple weeks ago, and I really wanted to get his take, because him and I, you know, when he was in Congress, we would have lunch once a month, and while I was chairman, and we really kind of just walked through things in. You know, as it was happening live of where the Republican Party was going, and just really expressed our disappointment and dissatisfaction. But I want to get your take, because you've been, you know, at a really high level in this arena for a very long time. How did we get here?
Well,
I know it's a big slowly, question.
I mean, yes, slowly, gradually, and then all at once.
Yeah, right.
These things go. You know, it's something that I think about a great deal, and continue to be amazed about the complete collapse of the Republican Party and what's happening right now, which does feel like, you know, kind of closing the doom loop. I think that last week felt like it was the exclamation point on the Republican Party's complete capitulation to Donald Trump. I gave an interview to Politico magazine, and I said, you know, I do think it's important to separate out, you know, the surrender to Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020 and 2024, they were all shocking in their own ways. Mm-hmm. And I'm still amazed at what happened here with Wisconsin Republicans who were really skeptical of Donald Trump, voted against him overwhelmingly in the primary, but then fell into line.
Yeah.
But in 2026, and I hope people don't misunderstand me because I'm not defending this, but I'm just walking through how the nature of the surrender has gotten worse. So in 2016, you could at least rationalize that, oh, Donald Trump would grow into the presidency.
Yes.
Okay, well, he didn't. But in 2020, he was the incumbent president. There was a lot at stake. So you could kind of understand that. But think about what it means now for the Republican Party to rule over for Donald Trump. Think of all the things that have happened. And I was sort of speculating, imagine if we were in some sort of a vast, you know, simulation and said, okay, so what if he didn't just joke about grabbing women by their private parts? What if he actually raped a woman?
Mm-hmm.
What if he actually tried to overthrow the government? What if he actually incited violence? What would happen then? And the answer is the Republican Party looks at that, they're shrugging their shoulders, and they're saying, yeah, we're fine with that.
Mm-hmm.
Four more years.
Right.
And so what you've had is the transformation of the Republican Party from a party, and this is not an original thought, into something that's indistinguishable from a cult.
Right.
And there's been no principle, no value, no issue that they have not been willing to surrender in order to basically stay in the good graces of this one man, which is really, truly remarkable.
And you know, read it. It's funny. 2 weeks ago, I had this conversation again with Reed Ribble about, you know, where did we get here? And I remember, you know, because I came into politics in like 2008-ish, you know, when I was out of just out of high school and really learning the ropes and all of that. And so I saw the rise of the Tea Party. And so, I mean, and stupid me thinking of that, you know, that was really where it started. But then, you know, Reed, who's an encyclopedia, was, well, a couple hundred years ago, and he kind of gave us the whole history of the world. But, you know, this extreme notion, you know, is frightening. I had a conversation with Russ Feingold a couple of years ago, and he talked about how during the Clinton administration, he's like, when they had a balanced budget, senators were going back and forth from, you know, to each one of their offices. They had like running bets. Hey, if we save the budget X amount, you know, loser buys lunch, right? Stuff like that. And he said, I never felt more American than when that was happening, because it didn't matter what letter was behind your name. We were all doing this for the good of the country. We were doing this for the people we represent. Doesn't matter who. And that's unheard of now.
No, it's unthinkable now. I mean, that's an artifact from the before times. And you know, it is, you know, for people who haven't been around a long time, what you're experiencing now is not normal. There once was a time when people did put country ahead of party. Now,
right.
I mean, obviously there are exceptions to that, but there was bipartisanship. There were guardrails. There were people who said, no, you know what, we're not going to embrace this bizarre extremist conspiracy theory. And to watch the collapse of all of that in a very, very short period of time is extraordinary, including, you know, including in the information media sphere, where we've gone, I'm old enough to remember when the mainstream media was in absolute dominance. And I think there was a liberal bias. That was not a myth. But now we've created these alternative reality silos that are impenetrable. And so that you can live in your own reality. I think my friend David French calls it your own bespoke reality, and you never have to deal with a contrary argument. And really, it's hard to see how you come out of that, because we have 40% of Americans who will never even hear of some of the things that you and I are talking about, who will never read any of these stories.
Yeah, no, and it's not like it's, you know, wondering whether or not climate change is real. It's wondering, you know, there are people who, you know, think Newsmax is a far leftist organization, who think that, you know, I'm sure you've seen the little reels on Facebook or, you know, Instagram or whatever, where there are people who think that Donald Trump is president, and there's a difference between the president of the United States and the commander in chief. And like, and when Reid was in Congress, we would talk about the Tea Party, because he would lament about, you know, how he would get so much grief for being in No Labels, right?
Yes.
And we would always talk about, well, who is your base? You know, and there was 20, 30,000 people that would both vote for him and Barack Obama. Where is that now? You know, we got a minute and a half, but where are those people?
Well, it's gone. Yeah, I mean, there are voters. Look, we live in Wisconsin that voted twice for Barack Obama and then voted for Donald Trump. There are counties that Barack Obama carried and that were then carried by Donald Trump. You know, go figure. But that's becoming increasingly rare, because everybody has descended into their own tribes.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really shameful thing. And I think, you know, I don't know what people do now. You know, and so to try to target as a campaign, which, I mean, you know the inside baseball stuff, but, you know, trying to target the minutiae of the minutiae of the minutiae is next to impossible. So we're going to hit another break. We're going to be back for one more segment here with Wisconsin legend Charlie Sykes here on The Rational Revolution. Revolution. I am your good and faithful host, Mark Becker. We are having a really fascinating conversation with political legend here in Wisconsin, Charlie Sykes. Again, thank you so much. It was on a little short notice that you said, yeah, okay, sounds good. So I thank you so much, seriously, for your time. We were talking before about, you know, kind of how we got to this place. And, you know, I wanted to hit on this question too, because I keep referencing Reid, but his thought was, we're at a point where we potentially could see the complete end of the Republican Party in existence. Like, what is he right?
Well, it depends, you know, how we define the party. I mean, the party has really ceased to exist as an independent political party. It's now a Trump party. Takeover of the RNC basically would suggest that it's become a wholly owned subsidiary of Trump Incorporated, including all the frauds. But will the Republican Party disappear? No, we're a two-party nation, and Republicans will still, you know, win elections. They will still hold Senate seats, governor seats in the legislature, which is why I think that it is so crucial that we have two rational political parties in this country. You know, it is not simply sufficient to have, you know, one party that says, okay, we're going to be evidence-based, whatever. You need to have that push and pull, that yin and yang between the parties.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time when I think you had a little, you know, a balance between them, but I think that's what's gone. So the question is, and I think, by the way, given your congressional district, one of the really tough questions is, what is the Republican future going to look like?
I know.
What is happening to the Republican bench? Mike Gallagher, who disappointed me on many levels, but was clearly one of the rising stars of the Republican Party. I mean, he could have been a force for the next, you know, three or four decades.
He has a resume of someone who would run for president. He does, you know, Ivy League guy, you know.
Easy.
Oh, God, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, continue.
Yeah, and he looks around and he goes, yeah, I don't want to be around these guys anymore. I don't want to do this. This is not what I want to do with my life. So if we're in a moment now where people like Mike Gallagher and Reid Riebel are saying, yeah, I'm out, we're going, you know, we don't want to run for office, who's taking their place? What is the future of the party? And I think what's happening is there's a purge and an opting out, self-deportation of rational centrist Republicans, or even strongly conservative Republicans that just do not want to be part of the Trump cult. I mean, Ken Buck out of Colorado is very, very conservative. He hasn't changed, but he's like, I'm done with you guys. I am out of here. So when you get rid of all of the independent-minded Republicans, the moderates, the conservatives who won't bend the knee, what are you left with? What does that party look like? And
scary.
So it's not just Trump. It's like, what does this party look like 10, 20, 30 years from now? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really alarming.
You know, and I think to bring it here at home, I mean, you were the godfather of the Never Trump movement. And I remember, you know, I was in that room with the guys from the state legislature, from, you know, Steinecke and Niagara and all those guys, when they said, you know, we are not supporting this guy. And then fast forward 7 months, it's like, well, where the hell did you guys go? You know? And they bent the knee and it became that. And these are people that are, you know, like John Niagara and Jim Stein, they are really, they're genuinely good people who are deep thinkers and, you know, who are really good for the state of Wisconsin. But, you know, it was even too much for them. And, you know, a couple of years ago, we were at, my wife and I were at the world famous Pulaski Polka Days Parade, which, you know, big political time where we see all the candidates come. And Mike Gallagher saw me in the crowd. And this was after some of the Ron Johnson stuff. So, I mean, he kind of knew where I stood. But we talked a little bit and, you know, I was like, how are you doing, man? And he's like, you know, it's a different tweet every day. This is hard. It's, you know, he was exhausted. It was difficult for him. And then, but to see kind of the direction that he went, especially after January 6th, where he was so vocal and then walked it back. It's just,
Well, you know, since you mentioned your Johnson stuff, I mean, obviously, you know, I go way back with Ron Johnson. You asked how we got here. You know, for me, one of the real, you know, just mind-bending, soul-crushing things to watch is what happened to Ron Johnson. You know, I had weekly phone calls with Ron Johnson. We were quite friendly. I thought
wonderful
I understood,
guy,
you know, where he came from. And then to watch how his brain has been broken in this particular era. And he's gone along with all of it and maybe gone even, you know, even further. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of that trajectory, it's the question you ask yourself, was he always like this? Did I just miss it? Was I just naive?
Right.
Or is there something going on that basically drives out the rational members while somehow crazifying the rest? I don't know.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about Charlie Sykes here in the Rational Revolution. And I remember that as well, where, you know, when his campaign first started and it was, who's this Ron Johnson guy? And then you go meet him and it's like, oh, okay, holy cow, this guy's the real deal. And then all of a sudden, you know, it goes crazy. And I remember, you know, when he was running against Feingold and he sat in Marquette Law School's auditorium. So this is my last election. I'm not running again. I'm not running with my reelection in mind because I'm never running for office again. And then, you know, we all know where that went. So, you know, I guess what happens next? I mean, there was No Labels, I think, a couple weeks ago. I mean, no, it was last week. Said that they were going to endorse a candidate for president. I took the article forward to read because I know they approached him last time around. And he said, feel free to share my name, but I think they're going for John Kasich. Like, what is this? What is this serious?
No.
Okay.
It could be dangerous. It could be damaging. But No Labels is gone off in kind of a strange, you know, kind of a strange cul-de-sac. Look, I mean, I understand the appeal that they would have. Like, we need to have a third way, and how disillusioned everyone is with the two parties. How people want to break the duopoly. I certainly get that. I think there is a constituency, but not perhaps this year. Because any third party race, I think, runs
it's
the risk
late.
Of being a spoiler to reelect Donald Trump. And the way they've gone about this with sort of the secretive dark money thing is just, it's weird. Mm. And you can kind of tell that that's the way they're being perceived, because one after another, you have prospects look at them and go, yeah, no, I'm not going to run. You know, whether it's Larry Hogan or, you know, one after another saying, no, I'm not going to be part of this. So whatever their future is, it's not this year.
So you think that the Republican Party will continue to exist. There won't be a, you know, it might be supplanted by the crazy Trumpers, yeah, or is it just one of the, do we just wait them out?
Well, I would caution people against just waiting them out.
Right.
Because I don't think this is going to end anytime soon.
I don't either.
You know, one of the things that that I think about a lot is how long a tail this will all have. I think after 2016, I thought, and probably you thought as well, that this fire would burn itself out, that we would go back to something like normal. But that's not going to happen.
Especially after his presidency.
People who are coming into politics now are going to be around for 20, 30 years.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I mean, and especially after the, you know, all of his antics during that term that he had, and the racism and the misogyny and the, you know, crimes, you know, I thought, oh my gosh, well, thank God that's over.
Right.
And here we are again. So, I mean, what do voters do? I mean, do you hold your nose and vote again? I'm not a proponent of third party because I agree with you. I think it takes away from, you know, doing the right thing. What does someone do in that?
This year, I mean, I will tell you what I'm going to do. And I'm not going to, you know, pretend this is not hard, that this is not at moments, difficult, but, when it comes to the choice between, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, it's an easy choice.
Yes, it is.
You know, you have to keep, whatever it takes to keep Donald Trump out of the White House again. So, there's all kinds of ways of, you know, rationalizing, well, I'm going to write in Edmund Burke, or I'm going to do this. Like, no, I think one of the things we've learned is it's either going to be Trump or it's not going to be Trump. And if it's not going to be Trump, it's going to be Biden. And so, yes, if you are, you know, if you have to hold your nose, then that's what you have to do to do that. And then we continue to fight out and work out these issues, which are going to last for a long time. And I think the fight, this attack on liberal democracy, and by the way, I believe there's an illiberalism on the left that is also a threat.
Yes,
but
I agree.
Right now, the illiberalism, I think of the illiberalism on the left, and I've written whole books about this. I think this is more like slow-growing cancer, whereas the threat to liberal democracy from the right is like a heart attack.
Yes.
And you have to deal with a heart attack right now. You call 911 and this has got to be our focus. Don't pretend that there's not another problem out here, but we'll deal with that in time. But right now, it's a 5-alarm fire.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting. And I think it's so timely with, you know, what you did with the Bulwark and what was so, what was really amazing about what you've done over your career was you haven't really changed. You know, it was always about, you know, a high sense of integrity and telling the truth, you know, country over party, we're all in this together. And then the Bulwark kind of morphed into the building a home for the politically homeless, which is, you know, it's there's no better way to look at it than you of, you know, I didn't change,
well,
the party did, you know, and to see, you know, the outright danger right now that the party has become is something that I never would have thought would have ever happened.
No, I agree. And by the way, I think I probably have changed because I think part of it is you look around, you go, what was I doing there? I mean, I got trapped in that tribalism. And the one thing I would warn people about is don't go from one form of tribalism to another form of tribalism.
Yes.
Don't move from Republican cultism to now, you know, becoming just a fanboy for anything Democrats do. Because, and this is something that I think about all the time, because I have to tell you, Mark, I'm sitting here in my office looking at my most embarrassing artifact, which I shouldn't even bring up.
Okay.
I shouldn't even tell you about it, but thank God you can't actually see it.
Okay.
And it is a picture of me smiling at a Wisconsin Right to Life event, standing next to Sarah Palin.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, what the F was I thinking back
then? Glorious.
Should I have known better? And of course I should have known better.
Yeah.
Of course I should have seen where this was going. And I look at that and I'm going, okay, what was going through your mind then? What have you learned since then? And how could you have been so wrong? So I think that humility about what's going on And one of the lessons I learned early in my career, and I probably, you know, let it slide during the real hyper-partisan years on talk radio, was, do not put your faith in princes. Do not put your faith in any politician or any particular issue. Stick to what is most important. And I just think that there's a danger where, and I have seen this happen among the Never Trumpers as well, where they go, okay, because we hate Donald Trump, we're now going to essentially also abandon all of our principles and now embrace anyone who's, critical of Donald Trump, they must be completely right about everything. Well, yes, they're right about the fundamentals, but it doesn't mean you need to change your mind.
Right.
And I think that, you and I both know the swing voters here in Wisconsin are not simply, overnight going to become liberal Democrats. And I think people need to understand that there is a coalition. It is perhaps a temporary coalition. It is a strained coalition with people who may disagree with you on 40, 50, 60, 70% of the issues, but will agree with you on the existential threat that Donald Trump poses.
Yes.
But don't expect people to suddenly change their mind on every single issue out there.
Yeah, I've always said, we got a 30 seconds left. I've always said through my own kind of, journey here, it's not about left versus right. It's about right versus wrong.
Totally right.
And it takes a lot of courage to do what you've done and to speak out like you have. So this is, like I said, the first show that I've done. And like I said, we're talking to Charlie Sykes. And I really hope that as we continue these next months, you're a frequent guest. And it's an honor to have you. And once again, thank you so much.
Sure, Mark, anytime. I'll talk with you anytime.
Right. Thank you so much. Have a great day, buddy.
Okay, bye-bye.
More Rational Revolution with Mark Becker on the way on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Well, how about that, friends? That was a really wonderful conversation with Charlie Sykes here on the Rational Revolution. You've got Mark Becker. And so we got some housekeeping to do here. If you've listened to the show, you probably caught the last episode here with Chris Alfheim. And she has spread her wings. And she is flying high to run for state senate. And so I want to take a little bit of time to talk to all of you about, who I am, why I'm doing this, and all of that. And I have to really start with a couple of thank yous. And the first one, I want to say a heartfelt thank you to Chris. She's a dear friend. I've known her for many years. If you heard the story we talked about 2 weeks ago, she was a boss at an interview I was at, and I met her for 15 minutes, but I remembered her name for the next 20 years. And that was the long-lasting effect that she had on me. And I looked her up before any of this started, and it was like a couple of years ago, and I just wanted to say thank you for really affecting my life as a young person. And so now I get to do that again. And I want to say thank you to Chris for bringing me here and believing that my thought process, some of the things that I could do, can really continue the legacy that she started here. And I might catch some heat for this, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you are in that district, vote for Chris. She is the tip of the sword when it comes to what we need in Wisconsin. And we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about the fact that for the first time in over a decade, your vote matters. Your voice matters. As we have new maps and we go in a direction of actually having representative government for the first time in like 12 years. Chris is doing it because she loves you and she feels that she has something to give. And let me tell you, she does. So thank you, Chris, Carrie Ann, wonderful wife. for patting me on the back and saying, go get it. Also, thank you to Civic Media for listening to all the dumb things I've said over the last 4 weeks and saying, yeah, sure, whatever, we'll give you a shot, I guess. so, you know, I have things to say, you know, but thank you very much for the vote of confidence and promoting the show. Because honestly, these conversations that we're going to have over the next, you know, 8 months and beyond, however long I'm able to do this, they're going to be deep and big, and they're really going to matter, as we heard earlier as we were talking to Charlie about how much they matter and how much is at stake. So thank you to Chris and to Civic Media. Thank you to my beautiful wife, who's very patient with me, my three children, and all the guys back at the factory. I'm a small business owner, and we have seven wonderful folks. But a little bit about why, you know, and how I got here. When I was in high school, I volunteered to help a gentleman named Michael Frona run for county board. He was a very dear friend and mentor to me growing up, and we haven't, you know, I haven't spoken with him. Maybe he'll listen. Why not? But he's a wonderful guy, and I kind of got the bug of politics and watching returns and all the, you know, the theater of it, the sport of it, in high school. And so I found myself watching returns and keeping tabs on what was going on in the news. We didn't have cable. It was the 7-channel special because I'm old. I'm not old, but you know, whatever. And so I really got bit by the bug of the theatrics and, you know, the sport of ideas that politics brings. I wanted to give back to my country. And so after high school, I wanted to enlist in the military. But as our producer Todd found out, I have a life-threatening allergy to peanuts. And so I couldn't join the military because a lot of their stuff back then, their meals were chock full of peanut oil. So they would give, you know, their soldiers and whatnot all sorts of protein when they're doing their basic training stuff. I have a problem with authority, so I probably wouldn't have done well anyway. But hey, that's neither here nor there. But I kept going with politics because it meant something to me. And I became friends with another Civic Media personality, Mr. Jim Schmidt, when I was in that age, and got to work on some campaigns with him. And it was really wonderful. And I worked my way up to working in partisan politics. And I found myself getting elected to the chairmanship of the Brown County Republican Party. I was the youngest one they've ever had. And I was reminded actually this week that when I was elected, I had the audacity to open up our meetings to, you know, members of our membership and all of that. And so the old guard tried to throw me out. They changed the locks and all of that stuff. Maybe this is why we have a problem with authority, whatever. And so we had to do things that have never been done in the history of the Republican Party. And that was to try to, you know, clean house with the board and all of that. And so, you know, I've been through a lot in my short political time. I was also elected, to the county board. And when I got elected, I saw the need in the community, and Charlie Sykes talked about, you know, learning things and being humble. And I learned a lot. I saw the need in our community, and that lit a fire. And then I married my wife, who is a Black woman. And I was even further humbled by seeing the disparity that exists in our society still. And then we have children. One of them looks just like me, and one of them looks just like her. And so I continued my efforts in the political realm, but just like Charlie, it was with a renewed sense of purpose and a little bit of a different fire that I had, because I learned a lot. And what I learned was tribalism and, you know, left versus right does not mean as much as right versus wrong. And so when Chris asked me to do this show, this is a show about right versus wrong. And this conversation that we're going to have every week that I would be honored for you to join me. It matters. And these are big topics. And so it is such an honor to be here. And my final thank you is to you, the listeners, for putting up with me. And I hope to have earned your trust to put up with me once again next week on The Rational Revolution. This is Mark Becker. We'll see you next week. But when you talk about destruction